Cambridge 105.
Community radio in your city.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour with Matt Bentman,
Ruth Reyes
and Alan Alder.
And today, Flavour investigates street food and looks at ways in which it might be further encouraged in Cambridge.
And associated with that, we find out about Independent Retailers Month. It's underway now.
And we also look back at last weekend's Cambridge Bake Off, which saw some stunning cakes being put together in the big event on Parker's Piece.
And in addition, we have wine critic Tom Lewis with his recommendations for the month and the review of the best of the food ideas in today's papers. So let's begin.
In the last edition of Flavour, Clara Paul of Books for Cooks reviewed the best new cookbooks. You can hear her on the Cambridge 105 website. I then asked her about how the food scene in London was changing. Now, we don't want this programme to be about anything other than Cambridge, but it might give us a foretaste of developments to come here.
Definitely the street van thing rolls on, and now these kind of street food markets. So actually, I was at Curb the other day, which was behind King's Cross Station, and loads of really great bands.
Oh, well, I was going to go over there before my way here. I decided I didn't have time, but
it's good. It's really good, and especially supposedly now we're in summer, in a summer's evening or late afternoon, it's nice to go. There's also been one in East London called Street Feast, which has been really successful, and I think they're moving on to find another location. So I think the supper club, the pop-up, but also kind of more spontaneous eating, like getting people together and someone setting up a market or a street fair and serving lots of food. I mean, it's hard to tell. These days, even I can't keep up. My finger is not so much on the pulse. Yeah. But I think that people, everyone always will love fine dining. But I think the emphasis at the moment is less on these really amazing new restaurants that are opening and slightly more quirky ways of kind of approaching and presenting food. One of the books that we really like here actually is by a guy who set up in an old ice cream van just selling meatballs in every shape and form, and he's done really well, and he's covered his ice cream van in AstroTurf, and he's at different markets. So things like that, I think people, there'll always be the quest to find the new thing, and I'm always amazed when I see yet another thing.
Yeah,
because I don't know how someone can come up with them. I'm trying to and not doing very well. So yeah, I'd say that's my tip. Set up a street market in, I don't know, a football pitch, see what happens.
Yeah, right. And any particular restaurants sort of fun at the moment?
Where have I been recently? I'm really enjoying actually a place called Caravan, which is not particularly new, but again, it's a sharing plate concept.
So where's that?
There's one in Exmouth Market in Farringdon, Islington, and also one right by where this Curb food market is in King's Cross.
Right, I shall look for it on
so
my way back.
So you can have a double hit. And otherwise, again, there are more and more places opening up. I keep noticing a real resurgence in, you know, hot dogs and barbecued American style food.
Yeah, place like PQ or
PQ, exactly. Yeah. Their book is actually just out as well, which is great. So I think maybe it's these flash in the pan things, but they're good and they're really fun, and they are specialists, so I think that's good. Whoever has set them up, they really know what they're doing, which is what you want.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, thanks.
So, street food markets and street food in general, what are the chances of them really coming to Cambridge?
Well, as you may know, there is a move afoot to have a regular food fair in the Gwydir Street car park. The person behind the idea is Petersfield councillor Gail Marchant-Daisley. So I asked her how it was shaping up. Gail, you've had the idea of having a regular food market on the Gwydir Street car park. Could you tell us a little bit about the idea?
Yes, certainly. I mean, it was really the Mill Road Winter Fair that put it into my mind, and seeing the great success of the food market there. And it struck me that it'd be a very good thing for the area if we could get something done on a more regular basis. And I first started talking to residents about it in early 2012, and the response was overwhelmingly, in fact, unequivocally positive. I sounded out some traders as well, and they also were interested in the idea. And it's grown from there. And the Mill Road coordinator has been helpful in taking that on, liaising with residents and bringing the thing forward. And so from that initial idea, it now seems that it's going to become a reality, which I'm delighted about.
Right. And you say regular, but how frequent?
They're talking at the moment about 4 times a year, including the winter fair. Ideally, I would like to see it monthly. But these things, you know, take time to bed down, and it may well be that quarterly works. But I think once we've got the idea of the food fair or market established, then if there is a call for it to be held more often, then that's something that can be looked at. I think the main thing is to get it up and running.
Is it possible to ensure that local suppliers, local traders get pitches there?
Yes, and I think it's important that we do. This is, after all, a local initiative. And it's certainly right that local traders and producers will be given first call. And it's only when pitches have to be filled that aren't filled by local people that will go further afield.
Yeah. Do you think this might lead to similar initiatives in other parts of Cambridge?
I don't see any reason why it shouldn't. I think that people will look at this carefully to see how successful it will be, and I think it will be successful in bringing more people to the area, in sort of livening up the area. We all know the great atmosphere there is in Mill Road around the winter fair, and if we can replicate that even on a small scale, I think that other areas will look at this and will think, well, there isn't any reason why we can't do something in our area, whether that's north of the river or elsewhere.
And Will, are you envisaging people just selling basic produce, or will they be selling things that you can eat there and then, you know, street food?
It's going to be a mixture of producers and retailers. So I should imagine that mix will be in there. But I think the devil in that detail has yet to be worked out.
Mm. And when's it likely to start?
Well, we were hoping for September, but my latest information is that it may be optimistic. So there'll be the food fair at the Mill Road Winter Fair in December, and the most likely standalone food fair is now going to be in March, we think, which is frustrating, but I appreciate these things take time.
Well, I think we look forward to it then. Let us know if there's any developments.
Be happy to.
Okay, thanks very much.
So thanks to Gail March and Daisley, and I think that sounds very hopeful. It's probably invidious to single them out, but there are two purveyors of street food in Cambridge who really show how good, exciting and innovative street food can be. They are Jack's Gelato and Leo Rietoff's Steak and Honour. I spoke to Jack in a sunny but windy spot outside where he makes his gelato.
Jack, how long have you been making your gelato?
I've been making it in restaurants for about 12 years. I've been doing it as a dedicated business for 2, so this is my 3rd summer.
And what got you involved in it?
I had a daughter 3 years ago and moved back from Paris, where I was working in restaurants, to Cambridge, where I grew up. And I wanted to continue to work with food, but I didn't want to be in the restaurant for 15 hours a day. I'd seen this whole kind of proper, genuine street food movement happening in the States, and that was coming to London and stuff. And I wanted to do something within that, and then something, but then something that was still along the same kind of lines of what I was doing, of working with really good ingredients and creating something really beautiful. So I looked at lots of different ideas, and my father's lived in Italy for the past 20 years, so I have lots of connections with Italy, and so I kind of thought that it would be nice to bring some of that to here.
Well, your gelato has had real plaudits, hasn't it? People have praised it to the skies. What makes it so good? Is it your technical expertise, the ingredients? One of the things I noticed about it is just how intense the flavours are, and also how smooth the texture is.
Yes, I guess I use organic milk, organic cream, fair trade sugar, Valrhona chocolate, Bronte pistachios, you know, blends of, I use Tahitian vanilla and Madagascan vanilla and use them together so you get the best of both. And I mean, there's no compromises whatsoever on the ingredients. And I guess people recognise that in the finished product. And then because it's made in the Italian style as opposed to the English or French style, so it's more milk-based and less cream-based, and there's less, if any, eggs, depending on the recipe. So with that much lower fat content, you get a cleaner flavour, you know, since your palate's not coated with fat, so you don't get that kind of richness, but you get that kind of light, clean, fresh, vibrant flavour.
But also some of the combinations of flavours are imaginative, and they work as well. Do you spend a lot of time experimenting, or are you experienced enough to pretty well know what's going to work?
I spend a lot of time experimenting, and that's what I during the winter, I use that as a kind of time to catch up on other things and also to kind of develop the flavours for the next season. So, you know, like the chocolate sorbet that I'm doing now was dozens of trials before I settled on the recipe I was happy with. I mean, yeah, there are failed attempts as well as successful ones.
What's selling particularly well? What sort of flavours are popular?
It really depends on where I am. On, you know, sometimes it's a quite a conservative crowd, and sometimes people are willing to try new things. So, you know, I've had days in which, you know, the olive oil ice cream or the cucumber sorbet or flavours like that have been the most popular. And then some days it's you know, it's vanilla and chocolate.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the combination of, I think it was vanilla with the strawberries and olives, black olives, that you did at Fitzbillies a while ago.
Yeah, it was a pop-up I did with Steak and Honour, and I like doing these kind of events because it is a chance to kind of, you know, A, you're doing a full pudding, which is nice, and B, you know, you can really have fun and you know, people are coming specifically for that event and they're willing to be more adventurous, so you can push the boundaries with how you do things. And strawberries want to have a lot of fun with, actually, since strawberry has a lot of surprising, well, combinations that it goes with. So it goes very well with, you know, balsamic, which is now quite mainstream, most people know about it. Black pepper, celery leaf is a surprising one, goes very well with celery. Olives, again, another less known of complement combination. So yeah, I like bringing these kind of combinations that previously belonged in Michelin-starred restaurants to, you know, bringing it to the street and offering it to people for £2. It's nice.
What flavours are coming up in the rest of summer?
I want to do... I've got an allotment, and I really enjoy using the produce from the allotment. And I want to start doing a few vegetable-based flavours. So things like beetroot and black cumin sorbet I'm working on, apple and celery, apple and fennel sorbets. So, yeah.
Wow, it sounds fantastic. I can't wait. And are there any particular hazards in travelling around with your ice creams attached to your bike?
There can be. I mean, yeah, not all other road users have the kind of patience and respect to accommodate me on the road. I got clipped by a lorry a few weeks ago. That was a little bit hair-raising and damaged the bicycle. Cycling across Grantchester Meadows is challenging. I've kind of capsized it. Well, I guess you don't capsize it, but I've toppled it there. But yeah, I'm learning as I go with that as well as the recipes.
So you're not going to give the bike up?
No. I love the tricycle. It's a it's part of the business.
I know that you go to Grantchester and you're often outside the Botanic Gardens, but never in the city centre itself. Why is that?
Yes, it's difficult to be a new street trader in Cambridge. So there's only certain areas of the city in which I'm allowed to trade. So I'm out on the fringe, which, you know, in a way I'm okay with because my product is a niche product in many ways. So yeah, I move around the city. I tweet in the morning where I'm going to be. I make it on a Thursday and Friday, and I go out on a Saturday and Sunday. But again, then there's further challenges outside of the city as well. So, you know, I used to be regularly outside the Botanical Gardens, but then now other ice cream sellers are trying to do the same thing. So I'm kind of still in the process of working out exactly where the best place for me to sell it is.
Yeah, but you can't be in the city centre itself. There are restrictions on street traders.
No, I need a pitch to be in the city centre, and there's a limited number of pitches, and the people that have the pitches have first refusal on it. So basically, you know, if they want, they have the pitch for life. So there's that huge kind of barrier to entry for new traders. They did a few months ago create all these new pitches in the city centre, but they basically, when I spoke to them, they said, well, we've got enough ice cream sellers, so you can apply for one, but we're not going to give you one, because so there are some opportunities for other people to do other things, but they're happy with their ice cream as it is.
Right.
So,
right. So there are a certain number of pitches for different types of provider.
Yeah, so they opened up like 8 new pitches in May, which the application's now closed for, but they weren't for, you know, for food vendors. But they said basically we've got enough ice cream sellers already.
Is there anything being done to give quality food producers greater access to street trading? Or, well, maybe what I should have said is there anything being done to give the people of Cambridge better access to really imaginative street food?
Well, to find out about that, I met with Councillor Colin Rosensteel. He's the chair of the City Council's Licensing Committee.
How do you set criteria that encourage the sort of high quality I think we'd all like to see?
This is the sort of thing that paid professionals get paid a lot of money to work out how to put into words, but we're seeking... I think the recent history of new pitches has shown that councillors know what they get, and we've got some outstanding examples amongst those recently added, I think, and we have high hopes of continuing that trend. And as you say, it's important to go with the market in particular and to try to raise the standard of excellence. It's something that City Council is keen on.
And with these new pitches, do you feel that the city centre will then be saturated, that there's no space for any more? Do you think that will then be it?
No, we've been fairly cautious on the capacity to add pitches. One of the areas where there will be quite a change is Sussex Street, which was pedestrianised quite some years ago now, but the space then created hasn't been looked at very attractive for the attractions, and we think we can easily get two pitches in there and still have room to for all the other activities one would hope to get in a pedestrian street. We will see how we go from there.
But once people have got their pitches, do they have them just for the year? Or
we've got some criteria quality we expect people to keep up to, so if somebody else comes along wanting to bid for that subsequently, then they can be displaced, because we're keen to maintain the best quality.
But once the year is up, do they have sort of first request?
They're likely to, because they are the, as in anybody who's established, they've got a track record. Anybody applying doesn't. But we will be fairly tough on anybody who we don't think is keeping up to scratch.
And how do you monitor that?
It's quite extensive, particularly with food. You see, there has to be monitoring from the point of view of public safety.
Yeah.
For food premises, and therefore, and the people, it's a city centre. There are people out and about. People complain to us that goes on in the record and so on. So we do have a reasonably round picture.
Right, but that's not monitoring the quality of the food.
We're not trying to do a sort of egg on runner job on it, but clearly, if people find that the food isn't very good, they'll make complaints, and which is another channel. Also, we do hear people who are pleased with.
So, do you feel the City Council has a drive really to try and encourage really good, high quality streets?
One of the constraints for us is that the street traders are only part of the overall picture in the city. We have shops, obviously, some of those are food establishments. We have provision.
Yeah, I mean, there was a suggestion some time ago that the market square could be used for evening food much more than it is. I mean, a couple of trailers, it's a big space. Could there not be more there?
The problem is it would be quite a different market if you had to take down the stalls every day. We are extraordinarily fortunate in Cambridge in having a 7-day-a-week market now. That's long, well established. It was 6 days, and then the Sunday market's really taken off in recent years. I think that is valued in itself, and therefore trying to just stir too much into the pot is something we've got to be a bit cautious about.
But it might be a possibility in the future.
I don't see more any extension of the present provision in the near future. I think looking at the quality of the market is always going to be an issue for the council. The trouble is most of the suggestions are very expensive and therefore difficult in the sort of public finance climate we are now in to envisage any happening anytime soon. But we are keen to support the market. It's one of the reasons why we're still trying to get the city centre shuttle bus re-established, because that provides access to the market for people who don't walk so far. I didn't have
one. And when are the new pitches going to start?
It'll be in the autumn, I think, because the cycle goes on up to mid-September.
Yeah.
So, do you feel optimistic about the future of street food in the city centre?
No, not really. I can see that there are constraints. One of them is lack of space. There's insufficient space at the moment for bike racks. Other activities like street performers need space too. But I don't feel there is a drive on the part of the City Council to encourage really imaginative street food. Small producers like Jack's Gelato, for example, would be deterred by the fact that they would pay for 5 days a week, but he would not be able to be there for all of that time because he has to make the gelato, order and fetching ingredients, and needs time off too. And the council doesn't seem to have taken that sort of thing into account. They appear to have only increased the number of pitches recently because someone's licence was not going to be renewed and he thought it was unfair. And the idea of developing the market in the evenings as a street food centre looks to be a non-starter, unfortunately. Can you imagine a nice summer evening in the market square with food the quality of Steak and Honour and Jack's Gelato to enjoy and maybe music playing? So, while I think we should recognise that there are constraints, I don't think there's a vision of how things could be.
OK, so when are the new pitches starting again?
Yeah, Colin said it's likely to be in October, so not too far away. But if anyone has any comments about our street food feature, you perhaps would like to email us at flavour@cambridge105.fm.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
That's right, and still to come up on Flavour Today, Tom Lewis will be here with his Wines of the Month and the Cambridge Bake Off. But first...
Independent Retailers Month is on at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and I spoke with Anne Prince about it and what we can do to support independent retailers.
It's actually a national campaign. It started off, I guess, a few years ago with just the 4th of July, Independence Day, was captured by the independent scene, and they used that to launch their own campaign. And then it's now sort of spread to a whole month.
And so which shops are involved? Any in particular?
There's actually a little booklet which has been produced, and that has all the information about all the different shops. Some of them... Some it's food shops, clothes shops can get money off. They might be doing competitions.
Right. Any in particular that...
Through Independent Cambridge, through the independents that are featured in the book, we're working with 8 in particular on a direct mail campaign, which is an offer to city residents. If they get one of our lovely postcards through their door, then they can take it into one of the shops mentioned on the card, get a signature from somebody, buy one of our books and get them 15% off the whole.
Right, and that's your independent Cambridge
that's
book.
That's what we're doing for the month, yes.
Right, yeah. So that's places like what?
Everywhere from sort of Urban Larder on Mill Road through to Tabouche in Market Passage and La Raza in Rose Crescent, so you can go and have a meal. And get the same discount off there.
But why support independence?
I think there's quite a few reasons. One of the main reasons is that actually with a lot of the independence, the money that you're spending in that shop actually stays within the local community. If you buy something from a chain, then potentially, as you can imagine, that money is then dispersed to wherever that the sort of headquarters are of that place. Whereas with the independents, a lot of them live locally, a lot of them are involved in the local community. The money stays in the local community. They're very much into using local suppliers as well. There's a lot of collaboration out there between the independents, particularly on the food side of things, where you've got, you know, everything from Hot Numbers selling Chelsea Buns from Fitzbillies. You've got Balzano's, Urban Larder, places like that using the Norfolk Street Bakery for their bread. So and I think that's just fantastic.
Mm. So what can be done to encourage more? I mean, I'm sure the Independent Retailer yes. Month is part of encouraging it, but is there anything else that can be done, do you think?
I think it's one of those things, isn't it? It's like, you know, a dog isn't just for Christmas or whatever the saying is. I mean, you know, shopping in independence isn't just for Independent Retailer Month. It's just thinking differently. And it's not saying you have to buy everything from an independent. I mean, just maybe going out to the local high street, you know, when they can to buy something. Thinking twice before you click on Amazon.
But is there anything that the City Council perhaps could look at as far as helping independents or getting more independents?
With the independents, I think it is difficult for them. They have to be incredibly creative about what they do to survive. And I think we've seen over the last year or so places being a lot more imaginative, and it's hard, it's extra work for them. You know, I know Polly at the Urban Larder does things in the evenings now. There's
the late night eating.
Yes,
on a,
yeah, so they're changing their opening hours. Yeah. You know,
the breakfasts.
Yeah, so yeah. I mean, it's great, but it's also it is hard work for them. And I think maybe the council could help by maybe looking at the state of the high street now. And if they've got certain sort of licensing regulations in place that maybe were put in place 10, 15 years ago when the high street was a very different place.
Why do you need a license to...
You need different licenses to operate either a cafe or purely a retail outlet. I think another thing that possibly could be looked into, but would have to be done at sort of central government legislation level, is to actually look at when new developments come into a city. When you have a new residential development, you have to have 40% affordable housing. That's the law. And I don't see why we couldn't look into transferring that into the commercial setting, where you have a new development and you have a percentage of almost, you could call them affordable units, which would be more attractive for independents. But I think that would give places a much more diverse and interesting mix. And particularly somewhere like Cambridge, where you've got, you know, new development around by the station and in the city centre itself, and a lot of visitors coming to Cambridge. You know, how do we want our city to be viewed? But we've got a lot of people coming to the city as well for, you know, we've got Microsoft, we've got AstraZeneca, new employees, probably bright, young people, who actually probably maybe want a bit more from their local city.
So, thanks to Anne Prince there, the idea of having some small units in new developments that would appeal more to small traders does sound very sensible.
Yeah, it does. But there is sometimes a reluctance on the part of big developers to let for periods of less than 20 years, and that's obviously something a fledgling business just couldn't commit to. And there's also the fact that some landlords would much rather lease a small unit to a charity shop because they know they won't go broke.
Yeah, so not an easy situation then, eh?
No, but something I think we should continue to look into and to press for change where we can.
In Your Company is Cambridge 105's business programme, presented by me, Sam Davis. In Your Company tries to capture the diversity of the Cambridge business scene by talking to not only the high-tech headline grabbers, but also the sole traders and the startups and the experts who can help us make sense of it all. You can listen to In Your Company at 2 p.m. on Saturday afternoons every fortnight, and podcasts of all our shows are available on the Cambridge 105 website. Community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
It was the final of the Cambridge Bake Off last weekend, and Alan went along to do some very serious cake ogling.
Yeah, and it was astonishing. I've never seen such cakes. There was a lot of interest in it too from members of the public. I spoke with Tina Roach of the Cambridge Cookery School to get some background.
We've been going for a couple of months now, and we started off with an open invitation to send in a photograph and a bit about yourself and why you bake. So we had about 100 people entering, and they then came to the cookery school with chocolate cakes that they had made at home. So we didn't see them in action. We were just given the cakes, nearly 100 of them, and we had to taste that. We gave ourselves 90 minutes to taste, I think it was 87 chocolate cakes.
And then the winner of that went through to the next
round.
Well,
so we whittled that down to 36, and we had invited all our bakers to pick up the cake if they wished after we had tasted it, or leave it with us, and we then donated to the two charities that the cookery school support. So Jimmy's Night Shelter had about 67 chocolate cakes, wow, I think, that evening, which was a lovely treat, you know. And then we moved on, so the 36 came to bake at our kitchen in groups of 12. So we had three heats of 12, And they had been given the task of making just a classic Victoria sponge. No real improvisation or nothing too sort of personal, just a classic recipe. And from those 36, we chose 6. So that was quite a brutal session.
And what do you look for when you go, when you're looking for a sponge? I mean, obviously you want it to look good.
Yes.
You want it to taste.
Yes.
Moist.
Well, we discussed what the different judges felt were their priorities. And for me personally, as a chef and running a cookery school, I would say texture, taste and looks in that order. You can have a good tasting cake, but if the texture is not right, if your sponge is too dry, etc., it wouldn't have entered, you know, on the list for me. Yeah. So we were looking for those three things, and in fact I was worried that choosing what is a relatively simple cake with not very many components to it would make it difficult, but it helped. It was actually not so difficult to choose the 6 best ones.
So that was round 2. Round 3?
So round 3, the 6 semi-finalists by then came over to bake a celebration cake, and their instructions were to use the creme pâtissière, which is, you know, one of the classic creams in if you're making pastries and cakes, and to use seasonal berries and fruit. So that was their brief for that. And the 6 bakers came out with 6 completely, utterly different cakes. It was really fascinating for us to see. The 3 that have gone through were simply outstanding in their own way. They're very, very individual bakers, and I think we could pick them out. If I saw their cake in a crowd of 100 cakes, I think I could say now which cake comes from which baker, because the 3 finalists are very, you know, they're very distinct in the way that they create their cakes.
Right, and that is a pretty good test of creativity,
yes,
I think.
Absolutely, that, yes.
Okay, so that was round 3.
That was the semi-final, and we're now at the finals today with 3 of them here. Bless them. They were asked to bring the component parts, but to try and make as much of a show, if you like, for the crowds that are here today. But we felt it would have been unfair for them to come and bake from scratch, because it is a very hot day today, and baking in quite crude mobile gas ovens, we felt, would have been a step too far. But they have still, all 3 of them, as we would have expected, made their lives really quite stressful by being hugely ambitious. And we're seeing 3 amazing cakes,
yes,
taking
I've just
shape at
looked
the moment.
At as they're developing, they are quite,
yes,
adventurous.
Very adventurous. There's nothing that you have seen before. I would even go as far as to say that. And one of our bakers said that to me today. She said, I don't want to make a cake that has been made before. So they really are incredibly creative, all 3 of them, yeah, in their own way.
Right.
Yes.
Well, I'll stick around and see who wins, and perhaps I could have a word with the winner and see.
And that was Tina Roche, director of the Cambridge Cookery School. What were the cakes like, Alan?
Well, the best thing to do is to look on the Cambridge Bake Off Facebook page to see photos of them, but they were good. They had to have a summer theme, so Sarah's was called Summer Over a Rainbow, and the sponge was rainbow-coloured and contained raspberries and pieces of chocolate. On the outside, there was vanilla icing, milk chocolate buttercream, a chocolate ganache, and there were edible roses around all the corners, triple-dipped strawberries and homemade chocolate butterflies. It was beautiful. Rachel baked a cake called The Tides Out, and it was of a rock pool. The rocks were hazelnut and chocolate meringues. The pink and the green seaweed were made from homemade fruit leather, and the black seaweed was rolled out licorice. In the middle was sea-salted caramel buttercream and sauce covered with a dark chocolate ganache. There were shells, crabs, periwinkles and mussels made from icing. The starfish were made from marzipan, sea anemones made from jelly, and the sand was crushed amaretti biscuits. And that was a cake. And Sarah, who made it amazingly, is still doing her A-levels, science A-levels in the sixth form. Fiona's cake consisted of 3 tiers, and she told me what was inside it later. So here's the winner being announced, and as you will hear, with high praise.
That it has 3 tiers, there's something quite wacky about it, but it has Fiona's distinctive style. And one of my fellow judges, Deborah over there, who's a fine pâtissière, grandmaster pâtisserie, you should have heard the noise she made when we ate Fiona's cake last week, which was possibly the best cake that we have ever eaten in our entire lives. This was also absolutely fantastic.
The thing about Fiona's cakes is that they're done with scientific precision and yet with absolute culinary flair. Every single layer in here is perfect. Whatever you're trying, if it's a sponge or a cream, it's perfect. The technique is simply amazing, and to have cakes to this standard made by someone who's not professionally trained is absolutely staggering. So I don't know whether there'll be a loss to science that Fiona's won here today, and again for Cambridge cake eaters, I hope. Fiona, thank you, and I'll hand over to Laura.
Gosh, such elation there. That must have been an amazing cake, Alan.
Oh, well, it was. And I asked the winner, Fiona Macduff, to describe the three tiers that her cake consisted of.
Fiona, what the three layers are different in what
yes.
way?
So the bottom is a strawberry and champagne. So it has a champagne syrup running through it, strawberry jam. And then the middle tier is lemon and limoncello liqueur. And then the top is white chocolate with homemade passion fruit jam.
Right, so that must have taken a lot of deciding upon what to put in the different layers.
Yeah, I guess I knew it was for a summer event, so I wanted to do summery flavours, strawberry and champagne, the obvious choice there. And I really love lemon cake. And then I had made a batch of passion fruit jam a few weeks ago, and I thought, oh, what a great use of it. Bring a little bit of tropical sunshine to East Anglia.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, well, it was incredible. And after she was announced winner, I asked Fiona what it had been like going in for the competition.
Fiona, well done for winning.
Thank you.
A fantastic cake. What's it like being in the Cambridge Bake Off as you had to give over your whole life to making cakes?
Well, so initially when I entered the competition, I thought it would be fun. But it's actually been really stressful. So but obviously now in hindsight, it was amazing.
It's all been worthwhile.
It was definitely all worthwhile. Baking, I love baking, so the opportunity to do it for people other than just myself and my husband has been amazing.
Yeah, but practice a lot?
I've had to put a lot. So I obviously work during the day. I'm a scientist, so I work quite long hours. So it's been really difficult coming home from work straight into the kitchen. I've barely seen my husband. We've lived very separate lives the past 2 months, I would say, and it's been cake and more cake.
Right. But any estimates of how many cakes you've made over the last couple of months? Because you must have done practice ones.
For this one, it was impossible to do a practice because it's just so enormous. But the rounds before that, so I did 8 Victoria sponges in the space of a week, 7 crème pâtissière rounds. And yeah, it's been a lot of cake. And yeah. My poor husband's diabetic, so he's had to put up with a lot of sugar.
So you've not been able to eat any of them?
Technically not, but no, it's been good practice.
It takes more insulin, it's fine.
Yeah. Right, well, congratulations anyway.
Thank you so much.
That's great.
I'm so happy. Thanks very much. Cheers.
Thanks.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of work. At least she won.
Yeah, I think she thinks it was worth it, actually. And there's talk of the Cambridge Bake Off happening again next year, and we'll let listeners know just as soon as we know for sure. And by the way, 2 of the 3 finalists are scientists, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, bacon is quite a precise form of cooking, of course.
Yeah, it's also struck me that there were no men, and I'm not sure that there were any at any stage of the competition.
Matt, you should enter next year.
Oh, good. I'm so surprised by that. Normally people would say, well, that still doesn't change the requirement. There's still no men there.
Oh, Matt. What's the self-image?
By the way, Fiona Macduff is going to be running a masterclass at Cambridge Cookery School this autumn. So do contact the Cookery School for details as soon as possible because spaces are quite limited.
And let's talk about wine now. Tom Lewis has just come into the studio.
So, Tom, settled summer weather.
Absolutely. It's lovely, isn't it? It's hopefully the height of summer before the August break.
So, what sort of wines are you going to be recommending us to drink with?
Well, the idea at the moment is hopefully we're having lots of picnics and garden parties, lazy Sundays, long evenings, barbecues and salads.
Right. So, presumably the wines for July are going to match these types of food.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's lovely and warm, so we're having lighter foods and we need wines that are going to match those kind of foods. So generally that means white wines with the odd barbecue red thrown in.
Right, and the first one is from Romania.
Yes, from Romania. It's the Umbrella Sauvignon Blanc from Romania.
Okay, is that a country you know?
I know it reasonably well. I used to go a lot there on business. I have to say, I've never quite fallen in love with Bucharest as a city, but going there regularly, I became a fan of the wines. They're mostly in a style, it's very modern, well-made, food-friendly wines, plenty of fruit.
So what's this one like?
So this is a Sauvignon Blanc. It's from Bacchanalia and it's £6.49. It's quite an entry level, but there's lots of ripe tropical fruit. There's good acidity and a touch of zestiness to it.
Right, and what sort of food?
because it's quite zingy and fresh, I think it'll work as an aperitif, or you could serve it with mixed antipasti, grilled fish, or roast white meat.
Right, now, OK, so it's a Sauvignon Blanc. So is it a sort of steely Loire style or a tropical New Zealand Marlborough type?
This one, I think, is interesting because it doesn't fit into either of those very standard types of wine that we might expect. And the reason for that is it's got some late harvest character. And what that means is the grapes are harvested later, so there's a richness and a fullness. And the aromas that we're getting on this wine are more peaches and apricots and Gallia melons rather than the more typical Sauvignon, nettles and gooseberries. So I think for this one, if you're bored of a very typical Sauvignon or you like the idea of something different, this is definitely worth a try. And at the price, it's an absolute bargain.
Yeah, $6.49. Yeah, to be honest, I think I'm tiring of the tropical fruit Marlborough style, so I think okay. This is good. OK, the next one's from Portugal.
Next, I've gone for Portugal. This is Esperão Reserva Branco. It's 2011, and it's from Cambridge Wine Merchants. It's $11.95.
And I think when we think of Portugal, we think of port, don't we? And then probably red wines, but not now quite so much of white.
I think that's the order in which the general awareness is. If you think of Portugal does produce white wines, and the most famous one is Vinho Verde. Now, that's a very light and refreshing wine from the north of the country. This one is from the Alentejo region, and it's very different. It's a lot more ambitious.
So not like a Vinho Verde at all, then?
No, if you've had a Portuguese Vinho Verde and you're expecting the same thing with this, you won't get that at all. It's a much bigger wine. It's oaked as well. So the first impression you get straight out of the bottle is lots of everything. There's ripe tropical fruit, there's sweet spice from the oak, there's florality, and there's a toastiness. So you feel a bit like you've ordered the entire menu. But with a bit of aeration, it all starts to fall into place. So the oakiness settles down, there's a really lovely acidity that runs all the way through and a good savoury depth, and the fruit expression is very pure. So this one is precise and elegant and balanced, and I think it's got some ageing potential.
Right. From your description, it sounds as if it would be quite nice without food.
I think it's probably big enough that it needs some food to go with it. Right. It's too heavy, I think, unless you could chill it right down and have it at the beginning of a meal. But I think with all that oak in there and the vanilla and the sweetness, you probably want to match it to some food.
Okay. And I noticed it has an IWC trophy.
Yep.
And it's also featured in Ollie Smith's Top 50 Portuguese Wines. So that's quite a recommendation, really.
Absolutely. And Jancis Robinson, she reviewed the 2007 edition of this, and she says that it's more like a Rhone white than a Portuguese. She also said it's almost impossible to identify blind. Coming from a master of wine, that's quite an admission. So I think you could open it up and cover the label and have some quite interesting dinner party discussions about what it is and where it's come from.
Yeah, that does sound good. And food matches?
As I say, it is quite a big white, so I'd match this with roast white meats or something like sea bass.
So the final wine?
So the final wine for this month is Bodegas Bossau. It's called Monte Anton, and it's from Campo de Borja in Spain. And that's from Noel Young Wines, and it's only $5.99.
Well, that really is extraordinarily cheap, but is it a bargain?
It's an absolute bargain. It's a really good wine. It's perfect for barbecues or for picnic sipping. And the advantage is it's sealed with a screw cap, so it's easy to open and close, and it's got lots of juicy, food-friendly acidity. It's from Spain, Campo de Borja, and inland Spain is often more associated with rather dusty, chunky reds. But the difference with this one is it's from north-facing slopes and it's grown at altitude.
So in layman's terms, what difference does that make?
In layman's terms, we're talking about coolness. So it's not that sort of baking inland condition in which the grapes grow. And you can taste that as freshness in the wine.
Right. And what else can you taste?
In terms of what's going on, lots of expressive aromas of Morello cherries, plummy fruit, there's a bit of licorice and leather, there's some vanilla and spice, so lots of fruit to enjoy. But what makes this a real bargain is the substance as well as style. It's juicy and mouth-filling, it's got this lovely sour cherry acidity that's going to cut through food, and there's nice dark berry fruit, a bit of roughed-up herbs. This is a really good wine.
Right, for $5.99, Tom, this just sounds a very attractive proposition. Right, what about food? antipasti, barbecued meat, something like that?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's going to, with that good acidity and lots of fruit expression, it's going to stand up to nice summery foods with strong flavours.
Right. It's a summer wine?
It definitely is a summer wine. Yeah. I think it's very versatile. So I think with the acidity, that's going to make it good for the summer. But also being a red, it means you can match it with more strongly flavoured foods. So you could have it in the autumn and winter as well. It's a year-round drinker.
Right. And the alcohol level?
The alcohol level on this one, I don't know.
Right.
Probably around 13%. So it is a relatively heavy wine.
Right. And you mentioned Vino Verde from Portugal before.
Yes.
That's a summer wine.
That's very much a summer wine. Right. So that normally is typically only about 10%. So much lighter than all the wines we've been talking about so far. It's sort of light, lemony fresh. It's much more of a sipping wine. And the only type of food it's really going to match with is sort of light seafood.
Yeah, I think it's quite a good idea to have wines that aren't too high in alcohol for summer events myself. But anyway, now we are going to talk about musical analogies in a future programme.
Indeed.
Have you one for this wine?
For Vino Verde, yes, absolutely. So if I were to sort of think about what are the key characteristics of a Vino Verde, it's fresh and it's likeable. And it's squeaky clean, but it is rather unsophisticated. So for me, this is sort of a young Donny Osmond. And they called it puppy
love. That's not really very loud, is it? I was really going for something effective there.
I can't hear any young Donny Osmond.
Can you not at all? Well, it's in my heart. Maybe that's where you're
that's possibly the best place to keep it.
Tom, when we talk about wine and music analogies, are we going to be listening to Donny Osmond quite a lot, or can you?
For you, Alan, I could try and find some more Donny Osmond if you're a closet fan.
But what's the idea behind this music and wine analogy?
Well, the idea is, they say a picture paints a thousand words, or a picture is worth a thousand words. That, yes. That's always true, except in the case of a glass of wine.
Yeah, and on radio we have no pictures.
No pictures. What we do have is music, and when I try and describe a wine, I think what I'm trying to do is think of an analogy that will give you the feel. What does this wine feel like? Rather than just a list of descriptions, what does it feel like? And for whatever reason, I've just come up with the idea of, you know, you can listen to a piece of music and think, oh, okay, yeah, I can kind of see how that music is sort of telling me something about what the wine feels like.
That's a really interesting idea. So we'll try that out next time.
Absolutely.
We'll see how it goes. I think we're breaking new ground here.
I hope so.
Yeah, great. Sorry, Tom, would you mind just summarising, telling us what those wines are again?
Yeah, absolutely. So from the top, the first one has a bit of a Rihanna reference because it's the Umbrella Sauvignon Blanc from Romania. That's from Bacchanalia at £6.49. The second one, I can't think of any puns here, I'm sorry, is the Esperau Reserva Branco 2011. That's Portuguese. It's from Cambridge Wine Merchants at £11.95. And then the final one is the Bodegas Borsau Monte Oton from Campo de Borja in Spain. That's £5.99 from Noel Young Wines.
Great. So next time, Tom with added music.
With added music.
Okay, thanks.
I think we did quite well without the Donny Osmond there.
You should have started singing, actually. Anyway.
Well, thank you, Tom, for those recommendations. And don't forget, you can follow Tom and on Twitter as the Cambridge Wine Blogger. And he's assured us that not all of the musical analogies will be quite like Donny Osmond. So time for a little bit of food news now. There's a very appealing summer event that's on tonight. The Cambridge Food and Wine Society is holding a cocktail masterclass. It's at Hot Numbers Cafe, on Guida Street, which is also providing cheese, meats, olives and bread to enjoy at the same time. The Society is launching its signature cocktail too, and judging by the ideas that have been suggested for it, it was going to be quite something. Aoife Maxwell is running the night, and she did a cocktail event at the Eat Cambridge event earlier in the year, so you will be in the hands of an expert. It's open to non-members for £24 or members for £20. So it begins tonight at 7:30. Tickets can be obtained through the Cambridge Food and Wine Society's website.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually there's a picture on their website of the cocktail.
Oh, lovely.
Which, it went up earlier today, and it really does look fantastic.
Especially so in this weather.
Yeah. I think it would be a really nice event. And a very friendly one too. Now, if you're looking for somewhere different to go for a snack when you're in Cambridge. The cafe in Downing College is open to the public. I went along during the week because I'm always interested to see what these places are like, and I must say it's a very nice environment. There's the day's papers, there's shelves of books to look at and even to borrow, and also very nice sticky cake. And if you're in the cafe next Friday, you could wander over to the Howard Building between 10 o'clock and 4 o'clock for the summer exhibition and sale. And this is really interesting. It's of needlework done by prisoners. It's organised by a charity called Fine Cell, which teaches needlework to prisoners in 30 British prisons, and it gives them both skills and hope. And Fine Cell also sells their products, and embroidered cushions, quilts, bags and gifts will be on sale at Downing College next Friday.
And we were hoping to have a review of Tim Hayward's new book, Food DIY, but unfortunately that wasn't possible. We hope to do this on a future programme. However, Alan thought it would be interesting to ask Clara Paul about one of her favourite older cookery books. So here she is.
I'm sure everyone has a favourite that is a bit obscure on their shelf or that they just really love. And mine is In My Kitchen by Annie Bell.
And now, we've heard of Annie Bell
before. We've heard of Annie Bell before. She has a series of books called Gorgeous. So she had Gorgeous Cakes, Gorgeous Greens, Gorgeous Suppers. I think there's Gorgeous Desserts or Gorgeous Puddings. And they're very simple little format books of really great family cooking, delicious recipes. And this one is a bit more about celebratory food. So it's different events throughout the year. Birthdays, tip. I mean, and this isn't normally a book I would actually go for because it focuses a bit on celebration. So there's Christmas, Sunday lunch, birthday parties. There's also kind of like summer afternoon food, good stuff to cook at home. And she actually started out here at Books for Cooks. And her concept, she had has another great book called Living and Eating, which is all about kind of design and appreciating food. And I think that this is just a really simple book. It's got great tips for kind of entertaining again and enjoying food without being stuck in the kitchen all evening. Her recipes are great. They're always 100% reliable. And, you know, the page are open on the 6 p.m. and it's a nice photo of champagne being poured, people sitting around having a nibble. I think it definitely invokes the good life. And actually, as much as I'm loath to kind of buy a book that has a Christmas section, this is good. It has got really good tips. And not necessarily what you expect as well, which I think is good. And bake things for baking, good ideas for kids.
It's got some nice combinations like that wild oysters with wild garlic.
Yeah, really nice. Yeah. Yeah, she has very short ingredients list, but they're really delicious, like bread and tomato pochettes. I just think is quite a clever thing to do on the barbecue and not
and
very
pretty
complicated.
Simple, yeah.
Chicken drumsticks with pomegranate molasses, delicious.
Yes, and that
so
can be bought.
Summer eating.
That
so
can be bought in Cambridge. I've seen some recently. Pomegranate molasses is not obscure anymore.
It's not. No, it's more like ketchup now, isn't it? Grilled fig with Bayonne ham and rocket. So yeah, I really like this, and I've got I think nearly all of her books, and this one I go back to a lot.
Right.
And I like the photography.
Any idea how when it came out? How long?
Yeah,
ago?
It was definitely a while ago. 2004.
Oh right, and is it still available? Well, obviously it is. You've just got
We've
it off
got
the
a copy.
Shelf.
Yeah, exactly. It should be still in print, or it will be reprinted if not.
Right, well, that's stood the test of time then, hasn't it?
Yes, definitely. That gets my vote.
Right, OK. And that's called?
In My Kitchen, Annie Bell.
Right, brilliant.
And many thanks there to Clara Paul of Books for Cooks in Notting Hill. So now we go over to Alan for his regular newspaper review.
Yeah, thanks. And summer is truly here, but do the recipes in today's papers help us to enjoy it? Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall certainly do. He's celebrating the arrival of raspberries. And like Tom Lewis, Fiona Beckett in the same paper recommends some summer wines, well, fizz, in fact. Yotam Ottolenghi's first recipe is redolent of summer too, seaweed and watermelon salad. And I was wondering, have you ever eaten seaweed?
Yeah, it's really good.
Oh, really? That's something else I'll have to add to the list. OK. Keeping to the seaside theme, Mark Hicks in The Independent has a recipe for crispy mackerel tail in seashore vegetables, or seashore vegetable broth, actually, which includes things like samphire or sea aster or sea purslane.
and all Mark Hicks's recipes are for mackerel today, though he's not taking advantage of the fact that there are still a few gooseberries about, though now in punnets are much more expensive. But mackerel and gooseberries or rhubarb would be a nice summer dish. My current food resolution is actually to eat more mackerel. Anthony Rose's wine column in The Independent, one of his recommendations is a Botrytis Semillon, which is around about £9 from the Cambridge wine merchants, De Bortoli's 2008. In the Financial Times magazine, Rowley Lee's recipe is for pizza with anchovies. There's a good article about restaurants in Istanbul too. Now, there's a city with a rich street food culture. Have you been to Istanbul, Ruth?
I haven't, no. I'd like to, though.
Well, you put that on your little list.
It's definitely on the list.
And just as Hugh Fearnley-Whittingstall has an informative essay at the beginning of his feature, so now does Yotam Ottolenghi, and his is about edible seaweed today. You can buy them dry, but wouldn't it be nice to get them fresh? Anyway, the recipe is for seaweed and watermelon salad and is followed by crushed tofu with wakame and lime. Tofu? Do you like tofu?
I've never been a fan of tofu, no. Tofu or tofu?
Well, I say tofu, but it's probably tofu.
I say tofu.
Let's call the whole thing off.
I'm really different. Yeah. I really like tofu, though.
Right. I think it's the texture I'm not keen on.
Yeah, me too.
As long as it's not like a big slab of tofu.
Oh, okay. I'll add that to the list as well. Now, on to fish. Mark Hicks was represented at the Feast London event a week ago, and his team are doing some fish dishes there, although I didn't have one. I had a fish burger from Yum Bun instead. It was one of those rare moments when you eat something so good it makes you gasp. And it was the same when I had Jack's gelato dessert at the pop-up at Fitzbillies. But anyway, Mark Hicks in The Independent has a recipe for raw mackerel, which is a bit brave, I think, and for taglioni with mackerel and chilli, but also for a Big Mac, as in mackerel, which is designed for when you have an excess of mackerel. And he says it's also a great way of getting your children eating fish. When I went quickly through the papers before, I didn't mention Jancis Robinson's wine column in the Financial Times. She writes about two French wine appellations which are really now rather unfashionable and therefore cheap. That's Beaujolais and Muscadet. Both are less fruity and more acidic than current tastes enjoy. But of course that can make them ideal partners for food. Well, that's the magazines, but we'll just have a quick look at some of the things in The Guardian's cook supplement. It too has a summer feel to it, beginning with the ten best herb recipes. Lovely ideas like rosemary shortbread, basil, panna cotta, and so on. And there's a feature called Tresco al Fresco, written by a person who lives in Tresco, and it's what they cook for their annual beachside barbecue. Oh, and Rosie Sykes, I mustn't miss out this. Rosie Sykes of Fitzbillies has discovered an old-fashioned recipe called Cambridge sauce, which apparently goes well with steak or vegetables. So that's something else, maybe for the barbecue. But let's leave the Saturday papers.
Yeah,
there, Matt.
Very intriguing about the Cambridge sauce, though, I must say, because the only other thing that pops to my mind instantly is the Cambridge burnt cream, which is of course the what's the other name for that? Sorry, it's just gone out of my mind.
Creme brulee.
Creme brulee.
Yes,
the one.
Yeah, yeah. Though, of course, there are subtle differences between them.
Are there? I didn't know that.
Yeah, the Cambridge burnt cream has a thicker crust than creme brulee.
You know everything, Alan.
I think Ruth knows everything.
No, I didn't
Ruth
know
and
that.
Alan know everything. I just work the buttons. Okay, well, thanks very much, Ellen, and that brings us to the end of another show. So many thanks to all of our interviewees. Clara Paul of Books for Cooks in Notting Hill, Petersfield councillor Gail Marchant-Daisley, Jack of Jack's Gelato, the chair of the City Council's Licensing Committee, Colin Rosensteel, Anne Prince, author of the book Independent Cambridge, Tom Lewis, our Cambridge wine blogger, and, of course, Tina Rush of the Cambridge Cookery School, and Fiona Macduff, the winner of the Cambridge Bake Off.
Yes, congratulations, Fiona. You might be interested to know, too, that the Steak and Honour Wagon is at the Free Press pub on Prospect Row as we speak, and Jack's Gelato can be found at
the Botanical Gardens,
isn't it? Yeah, OK. Remember, following them on Twitter is the best way of finding out where they're going to be, and You can also follow Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105. That's where you will read news, we discover ourselves, and we also retweet food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources. The next live edition will be on Saturday, the 27th of July at midday, and you can find our previous episodes on our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website.
Join us next time. Coming up next is Saturday Lunch with Davina and Scratch.
Goodbye.
Bye.